This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. It's Book Week on Fresh Air. Throughout the week, we'll be hearing from the authors of all sorts of books. Today, two authors of lesbian pulp novels of the 50s. Anne Bannon is the pen name of one of the most popular and highly regarded writers of lesbian pulps. Her six novels, published between 1957 and 63, are Odd Girl Out, Women in the Shadows, I Am a Woman, Journey to a Woman, The Marriage, and Bebo Brinker. According to the Bloomsbury Guide to Women's Literature, Bannon's character Bebo Brinker has come to personify the 1950s bar butch and her ongoing search for true love. Bannon was a wife and mother when she wrote these books. She later returned to college, got a Ph.D. in language and linguistics, and became a dean at a California State University. Now retired, she's still uncomfortable revealing her real name when making public appearances as Anne Bannon. In fact, she kept her identity secret until the feminist publisher Naiad Press tracked her down when reprinting her books in the mid-1980s. I spoke with Bannon in 1999 after the publication of the book Strange Sisters, The Art of Lesbian Pulp Fiction, for which Bannon wrote the foreword. I asked what inspired her to write her first lesbian novel.
I was inspired by reading a few of them myself. I actually had the experience that so many women have written about in the subsequent years of going into a drugstore and furtively poking around on the kiosks that held the paperback books. And one of them was by a young New York writer who was writing under the name of Vin Packer. And her books were contemporary and sort of college-based, very new, but it aroused a lot of intense feelings in me. I read the books. It was very hard to buy them, too, let me tell you. It is scary to walk up to a drugstore counter with your arms full of lesbian paperbacks and survive the stare from the clerk, pull yourself together, buy them, and walk out with your head held high, and then figure out where to stash them when you get home. It's all a bit scary. But as I read them, I came to think that I can do this. I can write about this. I had absolutely no experience, but I had the feelings, and I had the drive, and I knew I could write. So I had an old typewriter. It had been through fire, flood, and earthquake, and I set it up. I was a newlywed, and occasionally my husband would look over my shoulder and say, "What is that?" And I typed on, looking neither to the left nor the right. And within a few months, I had a manuscript. But being nervous and uncertain and very new to this and very young, 21, and since I didn't know any publishers, I didn't know any agents, I sent this book, I sent notice of it anyway, to Vin Packer. And I said, "Is there any possibility you can help me out?" And she said, "Come to New York, bring your manuscript, I'll introduce you to my editor."
What happened when you actually met the editor?
Well, I got to New York. She, her name actually is Mary Jane Meeker. And Mary Jane, Vin Packer, Mary Jane, took me to meet her editor at Gold Medal Books. And he was a sort of a jolly Irishman, very savvy in paperback publishing, very clever and successful. And I walked in with this massive manuscript. It was about 5 inches thick. And but I handed it over to him. He read it very quickly in a couple of days. He handed it back to me, and he said, "Take this thing home and rewrite it and concentrate on the two young women." Well, I had written a college novel in which I had a standard college romance, but I also had two young girls who were roommates, and in the course of the story, they had become very intense about one another to the point of actually physically exploring each other and making love as it wound up. But at the end, one of the two opted for the classic traditional college romance and married the fraternity boy. And so the editor said, throw that out. Your story is the two girls. And that threw me for a loop because I really thought I had been very subtle about all this and that somehow that would go unnoticed and the traditional romance would be the part that everybody would like. So I pulled up my socks. I went back to Philadelphia, and I rewrote the book around two young women named Beth and Laura, and brought it back much slimmed down, and with the two young women as the heart of the story. And the editor, Dick Carroll, said, this is it.
And this was the novel Odd Girl Out.
This was the novel Odd Girl Out, in which, by the way, you will not find the word lesbian. Because I didn't know it.
I have a copy of the gold medal paperback in front of me.
Oh, where did you ever
sold
find
at the time for 50 cents.
Yeah.
and it says, Odd Girl Out, a confession of a shocking and forbidden love. Is that how you thought of it?
No. I thought it was a little bit unusual, but I didn't think of it as shocking. Forbidden maybe in the sense that one wouldn't ordinarily shout it from the rooftops as one might if one had a conventional love affair. I did feel that it was rare and odd. I hadn't quite gotten to the point of provoking a reaction in enough people to realize how far afield I had gone with this.
You were a newlywed when you wrote Odd Girl Out.
Mm-hmm.
You must have been going through some pretty confusing feelings. Your heart was in these this lesbian novel you were writing, but you were newly married to a guy.
Mm-hmm.
So it must have been a confusing time for you.
Yes, indeed. It was. My whole family had always been very traditional. It was a long marriage, too. And I felt that I owed that to my husband and we did have two children. My mother had soldiered on through difficult times. Her mother had soldiered on. I thought that was how one carried the flag for womanhood. You had to do these things. But it was bewildering. I think I must have known from the age of six when I fell in love with the Statue of Liberty that I wasn't going to be like ordinary kids. It gives you a clue.
What was it like after writing a novel and envisioning what the characters look like to then see the covers that the art directors put on the books? Now, these were pulps. These were novels that were sold in part by having sometimes lurid covers or very suggestive covers. Tell us about the couple. Describe one or two covers from your novels.
Oh, heavens. Well, two things you have to understand. We were not allowed to choose our titles, and we were not allowed to choose our covers. And it was a dismaying experience at first, until I came to realize that the lesbians who were looking for these books had learned to read the covers symbolically or iconically, that if there were two women on the cover, and particularly if one was blonde and one was brunette, and even more, if one was standing up and one was lying down, that was sort of a code. You could read that as a possible lesbian novel, and it would only take a few words of come on, such as twilight love or strange love or society rejects me or, these code phrases. And you had struck pay dirt. That was the kind of thing you learned to look for. So after a while, you got past resentment of the total inappropriateness of the women on the covers, and you sort of welcomed them because you knew that they were a way of making the covers, let's say, saleable. This is a passage from the second novel I wrote, I Am a Woman, and it's set in a Greenwich Village bar. The central character is Bebo Brinker, and in fact, this is where we first meet her. And the character with whom she's deeply involved is Laura, who's quite new to all this, a little afraid of where she is and who she's with, and feeling rather sad because she has a crush on her roommate. So she's come to the bar to forget her troubles and runs into this somewhat phenomenal woman who is showing intense interest in her, and which disorients Laura slightly. She's a little afraid to talk to Bebo, so Bebo tries to reassure her. "You don't need to tell me about it," Bebo went on, "because I already know. I've lived through it, too. You fall in love. You're young, inexperienced. What the hell? Maybe you're a virgin, even. You fall up to your ears, and there's nobody to talk to, nobody to lean on. You're all alone with that great, big, miserable feeling, and she's driving you out of your mind. Every time you look at her, every time you're near her, finally you give in to it. And she's straight." She said the last word with such acid sharpness that Laura jumped. "End of story," Bebo added. "End of soap opera. Beginning of soap opera. That's all the village is, honey. Just one crazy little soap opera after another, like Jack says. All tangled up with each other, one piled on top of the next ad infinitum. Mary loves Jane, loves Joan, loves Jean, loves Bebo, loves Laura." She stopped and grinned at Laura. "Doesn't mean a thing," she said. "It goes on forever. Where one stops, another begins." She looked around the bar with Laura following her gaze. "I know most of the girls in here," she said. "I've probably slept with half of them. I've lived with half of the half I've slept with. I've loved half of the half I've lived with. What does it all come to?" She turned to Laura, who was caught with her fascinated face very close to Bebo's. She started to back away, but Bebo's arm around her waist tightened and kept her close. "You know something, baby? It doesn't matter. Nothing matters. You don't like me, and that doesn't matter. Someday, maybe, you'll love me, and that won't matter either. Because it won't last. Not down here. Not anywhere in the world if you're gay. You'll never find peace. You'll never find love, with a capital L." She took a drag on her cigarette and let it flow out of her nostrils. "L for love," she said, looking into space. "L for Laura." She turned and smiled at her a little sadly. "L for lust, and L for the L of it. L for lesbian, L for let's." "Let's," she said, and blew smoke softly into Laura's ear.
That's Anne Bannon reading an excerpt of her novel, I Am a Woman. The covers of your book are reprinted in the new book, Strange Sisters. Mm-hmm. So let me read one of the covers of the book. This is the original cover for your book, Bebo Brinker. And mm-hmm. It says, "Lost, lonely, boyishly appealing." This is Bebo Brinker, who never really knew what she wanted until she came to Greenwich Village and found the love that smolders in the shadows of the twilight world. So we've got,
that,
you know, smoldering in the shadows, the twilight world, boyishly. Oh, and then she's standing, she's wearing like a skirted suit and sensible mm-hmm. shoes, and she's holding like a wicker valise, standing on the corner of Gay Street, and there's a sign pointing one way.
Yes. It was pretty ham-handed symbolism. They left nothing to chance. And, of course, Bebo has, as pictured there, I mean, that girl, if she came eyeball to eyeball with my Bebo, would have turned around and run screaming down Gay Street in the wrong direction.
Why? What did you imagine your Bebo looking like?
I imagined her in jeans and a blazer and a turtleneck with her hair short and big girl. I mean, she'd been working on the farm all her life, pitching hay bales and riding horses. You know, very sturdy, person, big person, and not somebody with a model slim figure wearing bobby socks, and even the sensible shoes don't cut it. I'm looking at it, too. I've got it open here. Pink lettering, beautifully coiffed hair. It's just, you know, I think what happened was that the editors sat the artists down and they said, now we want a pretty young woman, and it's okay if she looks a little bit like a tomboy, but don't go too far overboard because we really have two constituencies for these books. One is the women, and they'll buy it anyway. And the other is the men, and that's who we have to appeal to. The women don't care what the covers look like. They just want to find the right books, and they'll read the code phrases and grab them off the shelves. The guys want to find a woman who would be titillating to watch making love to another woman. I really think that was the guiding artistic principle, if it can be called that, that underlay the cover art on a lot of these.
Now, I want to ask you about more about the life you were living while you were writing, you know, these lesbian pulp novels. You know, you were married. You got your PhD in linguistics from, I think, Stanford University?
Yes, I did.
Raising two children. Was your divorce related at all to these books, or to your fantasy life related to the books?
I suppose underlying it all, you'd have to say yes, it was. I think a lot of other factors came into play, but that was one of them. I was never the person in a marriage that I believed myself to be, and I had to strike out and find out who I was. And it was interesting, when the books were reissued by NIAID Press, I was a little abashed, thinking that my position at that time was as an associate dean at a university. And I thought, uh-oh, here goes my job. But in fact, everybody was wonderful. And all over campus, you know, sort of little lavender flags popped out of foxholes. People said, good for you, particularly over in the PE department. I discovered all sorts of nice people that were very supportive and interested. So partly, yes, it was a watershed time in my life, one of those passages when the marriage ended, and I kind of assumed an identity that was more me.
What are some of the things women have told you that they learned from your books when they read them in the 50s or 60s?
The big thing they told me initially was, thank God that I'm not the only one. Mm-hmm. And that's how isolated people were then. But also that it's okay to open up a little bit, that it can be healthy. It can be a warm, generous, wonderful way to spend your life.
Now, were you able to take your own medicine about that? Were you able to believe that about yourself?
You know, it's funny, Terry. I think what I did to myself in that long-term marriage and a long-term career at a very scholarly turn of mind was to learn to live so well in my own fantasy that I never truly got out of it. And that's not to say I haven't reached out and tried. I have. It just never has taken. I have friends who laughingly call me the ice queen. I am not the ice queen. I am just someone who may have, in a sense, hurt herself or limited herself by being so tremendously good at creating a life internally. I do it wonderfully if I say it myself. I have to start writing some of this down and sharing it, I guess, but it's satisfying to me, and I live by myself. I have loads of wonderful friends, straight and gay. I love them all. I depend on them all, but I'm not, I don't have a gift for partnership in the real world, or I just haven't found the partner. I don't know.
One more question. Well, you know, I'm thinking, like, your books are on the same shelves and the same publishing companies with the, you know, erotic novels of the period and the crime novels of the period, you know, all the pulps. And did you feel comfortable in that literary environment?
At first, I felt somewhat embarrassed and self-conscious about it. I thought, this isn't worthy of me, and I really wasn't sure how to take it. But then my mother began reading my books, and she said, "Sweetheart, good for you. This is great. I would never have thought this would have been your subject," but she said, "I'm proud of you," and I thought, well, dang, if my mother is okay with it, bless her heart. And she was the most proper and lovely Victorian mother you can imagine. I'm okay. It's all right to be who you are.
Well, Ann Bannon, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. How does it feel to be called Ann Bannon? Should I be calling you by your real name?
Oh, no, please. Ann Bannon. Wonderful. Very good. I never thought I'd be talking to you, Terry, so this is truly delightful.
Ann Bannon's lesbian novels include Odd Girl Out and Bebo Brinker. She wrote the foreword for the book Strange Sisters, The Art of Lesbian Pulp Fiction.